Hello, runners. Welcome back, or if this is your first time listening, welcome to the Tread Lightly podcast. I'm your co-host and running coach, Laura of Laura Norris Running.
And I'm your co-host and running coach, Amanda Brooks of Run to the Finish. So today is another super special episode where we answer all of your listener Q&As. We often ask for these on Instagram, so if you aren't following at Tread Lightly Running, that's a great place to drop your questions. We usually answer one at the beginning of every episode, but we've got a good mix here, and so I'm excited to go through these.
Yes, I love doing these episodes where we just get to answer a bunch of questions because ultimately we're here to help you. And if the best way to help you is to answer your questions, I'm all for it.
It's kind of my favorite part of coaching.
Same.
Okay, so this one I really liked. Eat to compete RDN. Should you do a tune-up race while training or before you start training? And I think maybe we're saying sort of like, should I do a race at the beginning of my training to set a baseline? Because that's a little different than a tune-up race. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so it's one of those things like, you do not have to. If it's inconvenient for you, you don't have to. But both are really beneficial, I think. Like, I like to have athletes race at the start of training if they haven't raced recently, or do some sort of fitness testing at the start of training. A lot of my athletes are starting to be familiar with like mile time trials, 5K time trials, 30-minute threshold tests. But I think a tune-up race in training is really valuable. Doing one about, depending on your race distance, 3 to 8 weeks out from your race to just test, how are you responding to your training cycle? Where is your fitness pretty darn close to your race? And to just push yourself into the pain cave and remind yourself that you can run when things hurt, because we don't always get there in training. Training isn't meant to, you know, push you to your absolute max all the time. So it's good to do it for both physical and mental reasons before a race. What would you say?
Fully agree. I think if you're new to running, you know, there's no reason to go do a race as a baseline. You're new. Everything's going to be different. But if you've been training for a while and you're setting a new goal, then yeah, it could be a great way to just kind of set a foundation and know what paces you're targeting and things like that from kind of having done that race. And 100% agree on the timing and doing a tune-up race. I think it's one of the pieces that can be super, super valuable when you are aiming for a new goal, a new PR, that kind of thing. Just having that little bit of extra practice around race day and handling nerves and all that stuff.
That's kind of my goal for like 2024, is to actually do like more benchmark testing or a tune-up race before my races. Because over the past few years, it's just inconvenient to race sometimes when you have a kid, and I like skipped my tune-up race last training cycle, and it's a commitment I want to make to myself this year because it's so beneficial.
I love that. We're going to ask her about this later this year.
I know. Yeah. Ask me about this come like April if I stuck to it.
Okay. Next question from L. Zeph. Do you truly think anyone can run a marathon, or just know for some?
This, I feel like, is a trick question. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we have to recognize the privilege that goes into being able to do a marathon, both the financial privilege and the health privilege. Like, I recognize that for some people, it's simply not in the financial cards. It's not in the time availability they have, or they have health limitations that make it not feasible. And I know that there'd be like the, oh, well, you know, there's all these people who manage to do it, but we have to recognize the privilege that goes into being able to do a marathon. And that's not a can, it's just a reality-based situation.
Yep, totally true. I think that when it comes to sort of physical or health limiters, there are some, but maybe not as many as we often put on ourselves. So I've definitely had a number of folks reach out to me and say, like, I think until I lose X number of pounds, I can't do this thing or that thing, or until I run this pace, I can't do X. And, you know, maybe there's something to that. Depending on like if you, you know, there is a 6.5 hour roughly cut off for a lot of races, or you feel like at your current weight, it's just uncomfortable to go that far. But a lot of times I think it's just a scary goal. And so we talk ourselves out of it. And it's one of the reasons I love going to races and cheering, because it is phenomenal. The ages, the bodies, the different people you see out there doing it. And it is kind of a reminder that maybe I can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like if we're talking in the context of like people, especially who are already running and committing to training, it's a lot more possible than a lot of people think. Like some people are just like, oh, I don't like to drive 26.2 miles. So how can I run that?
I don't like to drive that far either, in fairness.
Oh, yeah. God, no. I don't either. The next question is from Tasha, and she asked, tips for urge incontinence. I need hydration, but I also don't want to leak. I assume leak while running.
Yeah. So this is a big topic, I think, and one that impacts a lot of women. Certainly not just women even who have had babies, though that tends to be the most prevalent time that we talk about it. And I think it's a good reminder to talk a little bit about pelvic floor health and strength. And this is something that has become a lot more common. And so even saying pelvic floor, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I've heard about that. Whereas 10 years ago, I never heard anyone talk about that ever. It was just, yeah, well, now when I do jumping jacks, I pee a little. And there was like no where for them to go to even work through that. So some women 100% have even done the pelvic floor work, and it's still a little bit of an issue. And that's also okay. There are some great products out there now that are basically just like underwear. So not the old Depends, not that kind of stuff. And that could just make you feel a little bit more comfortable to not have to worry about it, being able to wear something like that on your run. But really and truly, step number one, I would find someone to work through pelvic floor strength. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that. Find someone to work through pelvic floor strength, because I mean, usually if there's incontinence, it's weakness, but there are cases where issues stem from overactive pelvic floor muscles and tightness. So it's not all, like you could work on it from home, but it would be more helpful to see a pelvic floor physical therapist. And then also I always remind runners, just use the restroom before you go run. I feel like sometimes we get caught up in our busy lives and just skip that little helpful step and then wonder why there's issues.
I think I have mentioned this before, but Bump Runner is a program you can look at online. She does a good job. So if you're like, I just need some exercises, she has some good programs. And then I know I have mentioned this before too, but practicing your hydration all day long and then also not going to the bathroom 6 million times all day long. So a little bit of bladder training in itself is something that is surprisingly useful. So sometimes I think feeling like you have to go is maybe because you've been consistently dehydrated. We do also know that that feeling can sometimes be like a precursor to diabetes if you feel like you have to go all the time. So very different issues there, but just sort of something to think about. If you're like, I don't really think it's the pelvic floor thing for me, but I feel like I gotta go the whole time I'm running. Other things to consider.
The next one is from nightshift.nurse.runner. And the question is how to pick the right coach for your goals and personality.
A fun one for us. So I think it is really important to kind of know what has the coach done. Certainly, I don't think a coach has to have always achieved exactly the thing that you're going for. I mean, that's why Olympians have coaches that have not done exactly what they're doing. But I do think it's helpful to have someone in the realm of what you're looking to do based on how much experience they have. So like I have Laura Swenson on my team because she's done 100-mile races. And so I feel like when someone comes to us with a goal of a 50-mile, 100-mile race, the fact that she has done multiple of those makes her a much, much better coach than I would be to that person. Because I haven't done a trail race where I needed to be out there overnight or learn how to fuel in those kinds of situations. So I think there's a little bit of a balance of what has the coach done themselves personally and where you're at. It's a little different, I think, sometimes with road racing. Because I can coach a 3-hour marathoner, even though I haven't done that. But also I've had a lot of experience with a wide variety of people. How do you think they can sort of figure out personality and, you know, if that's going to be a match?
This is where I think an initial consultation call or initial consultation Zoom call is hugely beneficial. I pretty much require it for getting started with me with coaching. Like, we do a free consult call to start because part of what you get with chatting on the phone for 30 minutes is an understanding of if your personalities mesh. You can, you know, relationships develop with time, including coaching athlete relationships, but you can get a feel right away. And so that's always why I encourage athletes to do. Get on the phone with a coach, get on the phone with multiple coaches, interview them, ask them questions, both like related to coaching and, you know, if it's okay with the coach, things to get to know them a little bit more. I think that's a really valuable place to start.
Yeah, I've had a couple interesting calls lately where they've said things to me like, oh, I'm in this group and the person who leads it thinks run walk isn't a real thing, or like, I shouldn't be doing that. And so that's just good to ask if you're looking for someone to be your coach. Like, hey, I really like doing run walk. What's your take on that? Or honestly, a lot of people say things to me like, I don't like eating before my runs. How do you feel about that? And I tell them straight up front, I don't like it. So I think, you know, then you get to know the person and you figure out exactly what's going on. But it's okay to just say, hey, here's where I'm at. Here's something I'm doing. I love heavy lifting 3 days a week. You know, are you comfortable with coaching someone who wants to do heavy Olympic lifting and has this marathon goal? And not every coach will be, because that's a different thing than what they've had in the past. So I think, yeah, just being really clear about what your goals are is really helpful. Okay, the next question. I like this one because it's something I was personally going to address anyways soon. Derek Jokul, we'll see if I'm saying that right. For general strength training / prehab, are apps like Apple Fitness effective or too general?
Ooh, I like this question because I get, you know, variations of it a lot. Apple Fitness, Peloton, etc. So I would say initially, like, if you really are doing like the true strength training on those, like the core work, the Pilates and stuff, not the HIIT workouts, they're better than nothing. Like, they don't always follow progressive overload. Sure, they might not be quote unquote running specific, but if it's that or nothing, I would much rather you see you do that and work on some strength at least than to absolutely neglect it. What would you say?
So finally, I have seen things like iFit putting together specific like 8-week strength training programs. And then when you go through it, it progresses each week and it's building on each other. Cool. Love that. But that's not how I see most people using it. It's sort of a pick and choose. Randomly, I'm going to do this upper body. Now I'm randomly going to do this lower body. And again, I am all about it if it is just getting you to do something. But if you're actually looking to make progress, it's probably not going to happen unless you're able to find one of those systems where you're truly following a program fully for 8 weeks. I'd prefer to push people more towards finding a program. So whether that is Mary Johnson, or I've pushed a lot of people to Daniel Pacenti, or obviously I have strength training programs, or our coaches do individual strength training programs. So it's going to depend. You sort of said general strength. So for general, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's getting you something. It's effective. It's so much better than the zero that the majority of runners are doing, that I'll take it.
Oh, yeah. And like for my athletes who love Peloton, like they love the music in the background and stuff, usually what I have them do is I'll write on your plan, be like, week one, pick out a Peloton total body and then a Peloton upper body or whatever to do this week. And then I want you repeating this for 4 to 6 weeks, upping the weights every couple weeks as is appropriate. So I kind of give guidance on that. And so you can do that with these programs. It just, it takes a lot of deliberation. Is it a little bit more exciting than sometimes being on your own in the basement gym? Sure. I understand that. But yeah, I'll plug Mary Johnson's program. Also, I use that one for like 3 years now. It's fantastic.
That's another thing I just enjoy about the two of us. I'll be honest, we're not afraid to plug other people because there's room enough for all of us. Okay, next question.
This one is from Sharon DC. Again, I apologize if I botched that. How to incorporate social groups into a training plan?
This is another one that I'm guessing you get a lot too. I definitely get this a lot when people are calling for one-on-one coaching and they say, but listen, like my group is really important to me. And I think that's great. I'm all about it. The big thing becomes you being able to be smart with what those runs look like. So being honest with yourself about, okay, when I go to my group run and it's supposed to be an easy day, am I truly running easy? Or have I suddenly turned it into a tempo run because that's what the group is doing? And I had one runner that just joined with us actually, and I adored it because he was like, listen, I'll tell you up front, I go because I get to talk to people before we ever start. And then when we finish, he said, in between, I just go run by myself. I said, that's perfect. And I actually wish more people were open to that idea because it would give you the connection that a lot of people are craving as runners, but sort of afraid to go get with the run club because they're afraid of that pace discrepancy.
I take a similar approach. I will say I have some athletes who, if I know that their group is really important to them, but I know that they won't slow down in the group, it kind of, it's balanced out in how the intensity in the rest of their week looks like. A little bit of deliberate manipulation with some other days and stuff. So yes, it can be part of your plan, but I agree. Like, I think most runners in groups could stand to slow down anyway. People kind of get into this like group mindset of like keep picking it up, almost competing with each other. So never hesitate to tell your group, hey, I want to slow down today. Who wants to go extra easy at a 10:30 with me?
Yeah, I always think, especially if it's a small group, basically whoever has the easiest run or the slowest pace for the day is setting the pace for the group.
Yes.
And that's how it should work. It's not how it always works. But if you can kind of make that agreement among yourselves, like that may help everyone just have a much better run.
The next question is from Raytrup. And she asked, foot care, specifically blisters, calluses, black toenails, when to care at home versus when to see a professional.
Ooh. First, I just want to say get bigger shoes.
Yes.
And again, you can have blisters from shoes that are too big, but usually they're too tight or not fitting correctly. As a reminder, losing a toenail is not a requirement. It is almost always a sign that your shoes are too small. So maybe you need a wider toe box or you just need an actual bigger shoe. I think when I started running, I was buying 9.5s. I wear 11s now. My feet are the same size.
Yeah. The first thing that jumps out to me is bigger shoes, better socks. Like sometimes you just need those really good like merino wicking socks, but you don't want them too thick because then they can cause like blisters if they're too thick, but you don't want them too thin. Yeah. I mean, those don't have to be normal. You know, calluses though, like we're going to have some calluses on our feet as runners. It's almost like how a guitar player has some calluses on their hands. Or weightlifters have calluses. Like those ones, unless they're causing you horrible discomfort, like maybe they're not aesthetically great, but I don't see what's wrong with calluses per se, unless I'm missing something.
Yeah, I would say if you feel like I have tried the things and I am still getting blisters, like, okay, maybe time to go check with a professional. If you are dealing with any sort of fungus, professional. You're having lots of toe pain and you definitely know that your shoes are big enough. Also, good time to see a professional. But most of the time, we can deal with it on our own by making some of those changes, changing your lacing, the wider toe box, some of that kind of stuff. Okay, next question. MKBLTLC? I always wonder what it's supposed to sound like. Okay, so do I need to reach a certain goal mileage with easy runs before adding in workouts? Ooh, great question.
This is a great question. So the one thing I addressed before, even like a certain mileage, is a certain amount of time spent running. I think a lot of people start out doing hard workouts really early on and their bodies aren't equipped for it, especially like their musculoskeletal system. So no matter what your mileage is, I usually recommend like waiting 3 to 6 months, depending on like your other sport background, 3 to 6 months of becoming a runner before you start adding in workouts. In terms of mileage, oh, I feel like mileage is a really good one because it also depends on like what type of cross training are you doing? What's your overall training volume? But usually there's always exceptions, but I feel like it's usually around like 12 to 15 miles per week. What would you say?
I really agree with all of that. I think if you're very new to this, especially if you're, say, not coming at it from, I've been doing CrossFit, and you're just kind of building this base for your easy running, then I like that sort of looking at how many months have you been doing it and staying injury-free and doing it consistently before we start adding that stressor where the potential for injury increases.
And I think some runners like neglect this, and definitely I made this error in coaching early, but you can introduce intensity through like the elliptical first or the bike or something and see how you manage it like energy wise before you add it in. And it can be like just a short couple, 2-3 weeks process of doing that. But sometimes that can just help adapt your body a little bit more if injury is really a concern with adding in workouts.
Next question. This is also, I know we get this a lot on Instagram. Shima Masumi, fueling ideas when you have to wake up at 5 a.m. and be out the door running by 5:30 a.m. I swear, this has to be the most common reason for, well, I don't fuel before I run because.
So the one that I really recommend if it is truly like this quick of a time crunch and you're worried about digestion, liquid calories. Have a sport drink, something like Scratch, a sport drink with carbohydrates in it, like Scratch or something similar, Tailwind, because then you're going to get your fluids and your calories, both of which you need before running, in a really easy to digest format. 20 grams of carbs right there, out the door, ready to go. You can also do things like applesauce pouches, a couple of graham crackers, a banana. All of those are pretty easy to digest within a half hour's time. What would you recommend?
Yeah, so I am this person for decades, literally. I woke up, food, and started my run. And one of the first things I do as soon as I get up is start hydrating. And like you said, I started out by using some kind of high carbs type things or even a protein shake. It was like whatever, because it started just to get me to drink something more than just I'm going to have a glass of water, because that sweetness and whatever got more down. For me, like Cheerios, super easy to digest, not a problem. There's a reason that you see so many people talking about Pop-Tarts all the time now. Super easy. You can be holding that Pop-Tart while you're doing your leg swings and your lunges, like munch away so that you can get yourself out the door. And it is a quick, easy carb for your body. If all you're able to do is get in the sport drink and then you're doing your warm up and you've got to get out the door, then maybe also practicing fueling during your run. So that's a great place again for the applesauce pouch or the honey stinger waffle or something like that. So especially even if you're only going to be out there for an hour, but you didn't really get that much in before you started and you take in something else halfway through, you're going to improve your recovery and your energy for the rest of the day. So it's definitely worth it.
The next question, KEC_716 asked, what's the deal with the sugar-free running gels? If an RD says sugar isn't bad, then what is the advantage?
I know we both have a similar answer here, which is that it's marketing. It's playing into the fact that everyone seems terrified of sugar, and so therefore their product is better because it doesn't have sugar. There are some. So I will say, Laura and I were chatting about this earlier. Crank energy gels are something that I'm getting ready to test out, and it has less sugar than some of the others, but that's because it has more maltodextrin in it. So it still has a ton of carbs, but the carbs are coming from just a slightly different fuel source. So sugar is a much cheaper, easier fuel source. And so that is one of the reasons that a lot of gels use it. But it's not bad for you when we're using it in the context of your runs.
It's not. Yeah, it's not. I mean, the sugar really isn't bad for you. Your insulin responses during exercise are wildly different than your insulin responses if you were to sit and suck down a bunch of Mordens at rest. Super, super different. So like the sugar in the gels isn't bad for you. With one particular sugar-free gel, it uses non-nutritive sweeteners. It can cause GI upset during runs. Some people get headaches from it if they're sensitive. We don't even fully understand how non-nutritive sweeteners can interact with like gut microbiomes and health and stuff. And in those cases, like those ones are pretty low carb anyway. And if it's really the only gel you like, sure, it's better than nothing. But there's no like magic that's happening because you skipped sugar. All you're doing is missing out on a really easy to take source of energy. And it's probably playing to some like diet culture concerns. I could also read out a ton of athlete reviews of those gels that would just make people not want to take them, from experiences of having to urgently go to the bathroom to colorful descriptions of the taste and texture.
Yep. I think because we are on that, just a reminder too, so there are a ton of electrolyte drinks that are sugar-free, and I always sort of say, cool, if you want to use that as kind of your all day long sort of drink, like I mentioned, it can help you just want to drink a little bit more, like, but you don't really need a bunch of sugar while you're sitting at your desk, but you're trying to get in some hydration. Cool. But during your runs, the majority of those that are sugar-free don't tend to have enough of the other things, the sodium, the potassium, the, you know, all the things that we actually really want in a sport drink while we're performing. So just being mindful that like, cool, like maybe there's a use case for that, but maybe that isn't during your workout.
Also, one other thing that popped in my head is there's one of the non-nutritive sweeteners actually is similar to ragweed. I remember hearing this on like the Holly Fueled Nutrition podcast episode on non-nutritive sweeteners. And if you have like ragweed allergies, the non-nutritive sweeteners can like trigger allergy-like symptoms, I guess kind of back to those headaches that I was mentioning. So it's GI upset, it's potential like allergen triggers for some people. Again, dose makes the poison. We're not saying these are horrible, avoid them at all costs, but we're just saying, why take them when there's tons of other gels that might be more beneficial for you, unless they're really truly the only gel you will take.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Now I'm curious. I don't use that particular one because it tastes awful, but now I'll be looking at other things. Okay, let's make this one our last question here. This is from I Am Josie Grossi. Can you talk about beer as a recovery beverage? I feel like every race has them at the finish line now, so this is a good one.
Yeah, this is a really good one. And this is, again, like marketing is a powerful tool, I think. So I actually did I do a paper on this in grad school, or was it just an article review? But I did I submitted some assignment on this in grad school. 2016 study published in Nutrients compared alcoholic beer and electrolyte drinks and how they impacted hydration in athletes. It did look at them before exercise, but I think we could draw some conclusions for after. And essentially they found that non-alcoholic beer can provide some electrolytes, which is often the claim you hear is, oh, beer has electrolytes, it's going to help you hydrate, it has carbs, it'll help you recover. However, alcoholic beer in this situation actually lowered serum sodium levels. Again, this was before exercise, but after exercise, we want to replenish those electrolytes and get sodium up. A 2021 systematic review in the International Journal of Sport Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism found that beers with greater than 4% ABV, which is like your Michelob Ultras that they're handing out after races, fall into this category, worsen your fluid balance, kind of playing into, you know, lower serum sodium levels. So it's not a recovery beverage if it has alcohol in it. Alcohol's bad for things like, it can actually impair glycogen resynthesis, if I'm recalling correctly. It's not great for fluid hydration. So if you want to have a beer, pair it with a sport drink, pair it with water and carbs. Don't just count on the beer as your recovery beverage. And
yep. So there's actually a number of studies showing that alcohol impacts protein synthesis. So yep, it's impacting or slowing down that process of our muscles being able to repair. Certainly if you are using it sort of, I don't think most of you are reaching for it thinking like, this is so great for me. But if you're finishing, say, a heavy lifting session even, and you go have some drinks, it can actually slow down muscle growth. So it could just be like, more than anything, it's slowing down your recovery. It's, you know, it's not the ideal beverage, but like post-race, me having like a massive cheeseburger also isn't like the ideal recovery food, but it made me happy. So I think it's, you know, sort of one of those, like, let's balance it out. Okay, you have the couple beers, but then can you have a decent meal and a bunch of water and some electrolytes? Okay, I had the massive cheeseburger. Can I then get back on board with some fruits, vegetables, and things that are actually going to help the rest of my body repair?
Oh, yeah. And I feel like there's also a difference between like a post-race celebratory beer and being like, this is a recovery beverage I have often. Like, non-alcoholic beers can actually taste quite good. Athletic Brewing is really good. I know there's a few other ones. So it's like, if you want the taste of that after, regularly after your workouts, maybe consider that. Again, there's nothing wrong if you want alcohol for fun, but don't deliberately reach for it thinking this is going to help me recover better from my long run or my hard tempo run or something.
Yeah, it really is good marketing when they have tried to convince you that like this is the thing that's like so great after. All right, awesome. I think that was a fun one to end on. So keep your questions coming. And most importantly, please do share the podcast. If you know a friend who's a runner and you think, man, this is something that they would really benefit from, we would super appreciate it.
Yes. And as always, please rate, review, subscribe, reach out to us at Tread Lightly Running. And thank you so much.